Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I am Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. This is the second in a series of weekly minisodes focused on Doctor Who Series 9. Today we'll talk about The Witch's Familiar by Stephen Moffat, which is the second part of last week's story, The Magician's Apprentice. And as you can probably tell, we're once again using Google Voice to make this all happen, recording over our telephone, so it probably sounds like we're on our telephone. So just pretend we're giving you your own personal phone call, something nice and cozy, intimate. Maybe we should change our opening to, what are you wearing? But we'll think about that. Okay, one last thing before we start. We plan to spoil the bejeepers out of The Witch's Familiar, so consider yourself warned. All right, guys, round one, temporal grace. We start each and every weekly podcast with something we loved about the current episode. That's sometimes harder for some of us than others. Pat?
So I'm going to continue my theme from last week, and I'm going to admire the old-school continuity references. Specifically here, I want to reference the two, at least two, quotations from Tom Baker's story, Destiny of the Daleks, that the Daleks use. They say, seek, locate, exterminate. And also, of course, the classic, my vision is impaired, I cannot see. My vision is impaired, I cannot see. Which I know is a favorite of Kelvin's, and but we won't get into that right now. And for me, it was very charming because regular listeners of this podcast may or may not know that we just recorded a one-year anniversary special as a live show at the Bryant Lake Bowl here in Minneapolis, and the one of the things that was under discussion was the episode Destiny of the Daleks. So it was nice to just hear these things immediately afterward. As soon as we were done with this, practically, it was on our screens again.
Okay, Kelvin, what was your favorite?
Probably, and I was going to make a point of looking up his name, and I forgot it again, but the performance of the actor playing Davros was
Julian Bleach. Incredible.
Julian, he was absolutely incredible. You know, I was completely faked out by, oh my God, is Davros actually reforming? I really genuinely bought that completely, and doing that through a big latex mask while you're sitting down, you know, with no body language. Honestly, it's one of the better acting jobs I've seen on a TV show in quite a while.
I did really love his performance in this. But probably, oddly, my favorite thing about this episode relates to our podcast and Kelvin's gift of prophecy. Because during last week's podcast, you mentioned the killing joke in relation to the Doctor's relationship with the Master. And then, lo and behold, it's not with the Master, but we get the Doctor and Davros acting out the end of the killing joke in this episode.
Yeah, they both crack up
laughing together.
They share a joke, yes. Right?
Wow.
You must be reading my mail. I'm looking at that line in my notes right now. I was going to reference it, but you got to it before me.
And if anyone out there hasn't read The Killing Joke, go read it. We maybe have spoiled that, too. We should have put that in the warning. Round two, Doctor in Distress, because this Doctor continues to seem burdened and dark, and his character is still developing, so we will talk a little about the 12th Doctor, as this episode portrayed him. Pat, last week, I remember you said you had to get back in the groove of New Who, and there was something that didn't quite feel right about the 12th for you yet, like a suit you had to fit back into. I can't remember, I'm terribly misquoting you, but did it click with you this episode?
Yeah, you know, I'm getting there. And none of this is really Capaldi's performance, I think. I pretty much like him throughout, but I think maybe what I'm still resisting is the script's constant conceptual positioning of who the Doctor is. We ended last season with him just saying, you know, I'm an idiot in a box or whatever he said. And in this episode we get, he's a bloke in a box telling stories, but if he tries very hard, he's also the Time Lord that ran away. And then we have a whole thing that's actually much better about compassion and the idea of compassion. But, it's the sense that he constantly has to write his character into the script as if there hasn't been 50 years of Doctor stories where we can just kind of take it for granted that there is something out there called the Doctor that doesn't constantly need to be redefined through dialogue and can simply enact itself through, you know, the movements of the plot. And so that's, for me, it's always like going forward with a handbrake on, right? It's just, well, we're just going to kind of trudge a little bit here because we need to self-define every time. It's like they don't trust Capaldi to carry what he's, you know, the weight of what the story has in terms of its meaning without explicitly saying what his character is at any particular moment. And maybe that's a function that they're trying to redefine him between the seasons, too. They tried to do this kind of dark thing last season, and they brought it to a point. The whole thing was a little bit muddy. Am I a good man? And they brought it to a point where he's just like, oh, okay, now I'm the Doctor doing my thing again. And so now they need to launch off into this hoodie-wearing, sunglass-wearing Doctor, and so maybe they feel like they need to spend some time redefining it a bit. So I think that sounds a little more negative than my actual takeaway from it was, but it was it was a little tiring for me to spend a lot of time on self-definition of the Doctor when we could just be going on and doing Doctor Who stories, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. I think a little break from that would be nice, and I think we got a little break from it with Matt Smith. David Tennant used to do a lot of self-defining as well. I think there's something in the Day of the Doctor where the burden of the Time Lord was lifted, and I think we have this old series perspective, and so I think our natural inclination was to believe that they were going to take this burden away from the Doctor, and it would be more like the classic series, and not have as dark of a characterization, a troubled characterization of the Doctor. But I think the show's been going now for 10 years. The people who grew up on the new series, I've read since Day of the Doctor, a lot of people who are really upset about erasing that is their kind of defining thing about the Doctor, that he has this terrible tragedy in his past. And so I think, to me, it looks like with these two seasons with Capaldi that Moffat is kind of trying to give him a burden of the season to kind of replace the Time War and keep that emo angle in there. I could be wrong, but that's kind of what it feels like to me. Calvin, do you have any thoughts?
I've seen a lot of complaints in this episode about doing that thing of pointing out, look how cool the Doctor is. Like, the whole, where did I get a cup of tea thing, which doesn't really have anything to do with anything. It's just there to sort of make him look kind of, I don't know, badass in a totally nonviolent way or something. I don't know. That didn't really bother me as much as when it was done during Tennant. And again, I'm not sure how much of that is Tennant's performance versus Capaldi's performance or Davies writing versus Moffat's writing, or if I'm just kind of used to it now, or if it's just because Capaldi's physically older that somehow I can kind of buy it more. I don't know.
Did you feel, Calvin, that was maybe a tweak of Moffat's toward his audience, because Capaldi says something like, where do you get the tea? Don't worry about it. He's the Doctor. Just go with it. To me, that sounded like a very meta-level reference, kind of an exasperated, oh, for God's sake, stop looking at all these tiny little details and just go with the story. That sounded like a very Moffat-y kind of approach.
Yeah, I could see that falling into the again, general complaint of Moffat enjoying trolling the fans or something. But again, I found it like a weird extraneous detail that just was kind of there for a cheap laugh or something. The Doctor being in Davros's chair wasn't a big enough humor moment somehow. I don't know. But
so you guys, did you think that whole bit with the chair might have been a late addition to the script? because that's so what it felt like to me, because if you were to snip out that section, absolutely nothing would change in terms of the development of the plot. It doesn't accomplish anything. Nobody refers to it again. And it actually kind of steps over the TARDIS force field gag that you get later on. Right? I mean, to me, this is like, it was, oh my God, the script is running short, and the Doctor doesn't really do much until the last few minutes of this episode, so I'm going to script in another 5 or 8 minute scene where he steals Davros's chair, which will be a big crowd pleaser, and then it can't change the direction of the story at all. It so much felt like that to me.
It didn't strike me like that at all, but now that you explain it, I cannot refute it on any level.
Well, especially because it does go nowhere, but I will admit that I am one of the crowd that killed me. I probably could have watched him careening around in that chair, taunting the Daleks for 47 straight minutes, and it wouldn't have bothered me in the slightest. And it might say, you know, more about me than about the script, but it killed me.
Well, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed it. I was just, because it didn't develop into anything, I was kind of like, oh, wait, did I dream that?
Or was the tea just a commentary on that entire scene? Like, just accept it. The Doctor's in Davros' chair. Shut up, Pat. All right, guys, round 3, friends and foes. There's a lot of them in this two-parter. So let's start with friends. Cleric kind of got sidelined again and definitely overshadowed by Missy. Struck me, I'll start this out, but it struck me as weird that Clara becomes far more of a traditional female companion when paired with Missy, because pretty much all she does is ask questions and get thrown into sewers and tied and hung upside down and trapped in a Dalek. Suddenly the very self-empowered Clara seemed like a very trad companion to the Master, but I don't know what you guys thought.
Well, I think some of that is wanting to focus on Missy and kind of, I think it's a reasonable expectation that all the fans wanted to focus on Missy as well. And it's entirely at the detriment of Clara and kind of turning her into the, you know, sort of the victim role of, I'm trapped inside a Dalek, I can't communicate. I
didn't even really mean it as a criticism. I super enjoyed it again. I thought it was pretty funny. And how much of it is that Missy's a female, so you don't have the same, like, gender issues when it's a female companion following after the Doctor saying, what is that, Doctor? So they can have her be far more traditional and more the butt of the jokes.
That could be true, too. I at the end of the day, I'm a big old white cisgendered heterosexual male, so I don't know how much commentary I can really provide on that. I mean,
at the end of the day?
Yeah, only at the end of the day, yes. Which genders a little, but, you know.
As a slightly smaller, white, cisgender, heterosexual male, at close to the end of the evening, I'll jump on that grenade. I'm with Josh here. I think a lot of it has to do with the gender dynamics where, in this case, it might not necessarily be Moffat trolling exactly, but I think he can get away with a lot more when you have Missy as a woman, well, currently a woman, you know, didn't used to be, but okay, we'll let that go. But Missy as a woman with a woman companion can be cruel to Clara, like toss her down a pit, in a way that would seem, oh, really? Oh, that's awful, you know, if a doctor did it or if a man did it. And I know this is one of the criticisms that our friend Tony Karna, our sound guy, had with last season, with season 8. He thought that Capaldi's doctor was just a flat-out bully to Clara. And although I disagree with that, because I think that Clara had been established as a character with a relationship with the doctor before that point, that I could view it with some good humor. That was not the case with Tony's reaction. And I think here that neutralizes that whole dynamic, at least to a certain degree. Like, we know that Missy is a psychopathic murderer. Also, the fact that she's a woman means that it's not sadistically cruel in a gendered way. So I kind of liked the change of pace. I liked the pairing of the two of them.
Yeah.
I liked Clara being kind of like a bumbling person that the Master was taking advantage of the whole time. Yeah, no, I dug it. I do find it a little strange that last episode and this one, The Magician's Apprentice and The Witch's Familiar, those are terms that must refer to Clara specifically, I have to think, right? First,
oh, yeah.
Doctor's companion, and then she's Missy's companion, but there isn't really much in the script that focuses on her, so I'm a little at sea in terms of what I should be getting from the titles. It seems to focus more on Clara than the actual scripts do.
I was thinking the same thing, and I was wondering if it was just Moffat having fun or if somehow by the end of the season a light might be shed on these titles or these episodes, but we'll have to wait to find out. What do you think? Well, we already talked about what we thought of Davros. We enjoy Davros.
Yeah, Davros is fantastic in this. It's like probably the best use of Davros since Genesis of the Daleks, I would say.
Yeah, I'm 100% behind you there. I have never thought that Davros really should have been used since Genesis of the Daleks. He was great there, and it was all diminishing returns after that point. This is the first story, this two-parter here, that I think he is worth a damn.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I'm also a fan of 80s Davros stories, but that's for a whole nother podcast or intervention later. But yeah, I thought his performance was great. Maybe this is moving into plot, but we'll just put it out there and maybe get back to it. The fact that the doctor seemed to know what Davros was up to, I tried to go back and figure out where in the conversation or if he always knew, and that kind of a little bit colors those last scenes to me, and maybe I just need to see it again to figure that out, or if it felt more like a convenient way to make the doctor still the hero after being suckered by Davros. And the performance is great. Davros laid it on a little thick by the end, I think. It almost felt like they were going to move into a comedy scene when he was saying, I just want to see the sun one more time. And maybe a little back rub and a pony ride to see how many things you could get the doctor to do out of pure guilt.
It didn't bother me, but it is like the most symbolic heart string-tugging, last dying request sort of cliche thing you could have a character say, I just want to see the sun one more time.
Yeah, and maybe that's the point at which they're really telegraphing that the doctor's like, all right, Davros, I know what you're doing here.
I don't know that the script is 100% certain of where the credibility lies here. I think it's safe to say that the doctor always knew that this was a trick of some sort, but how emotionally sincere they are with one another as they're getting to that point is unclear. It's kind of the script wanting to have it both ways. It wants to have these sentimental, yep, emotional notes while at the same time not deviating so far from established Doctor Who that things become unrecognizable. So, I don't know. I think we're kind of pushing the limits of what you can do with a character like Davros there, right? You know, we can suggest that these things that he's saying are emotionally sincere, but there has to be a trap inside it as well.
I was a little suckered like Kelvin, though. There was a part of me that really thought he was just going to die there alone with the doctor, and they were going to be done with Davros.
Boy,
that
would have
been
like
great.
A sucker. Okay, so one last bad guy. Talk a little bit more about Missy, and mainly I just want to say I have been fairly cynical about Missy as a character, but this is the first story that started to win me over, and I think it was the dynamic between her and Clara, and the fact that it was reminiscent of Delgado and that relationship as the foe who has to occasionally be your uneasy ally.
Josh, are you feeling okay?
No, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I've only watched it once. I'm scared to watch it a second time because I might, you know, start my own Missy podcast or something. Sorry, guys.
I've liked her more than you up to this point. I really liked, first, the comedy of Missy and Clara's kind of two-handed relationship in the first part of the episode, but then I also really admired the psychopathic attempt that she does to get the doctor to murder Clara when she's trapped in the Dalek at the end, because that's a great master moment.
You knew Missy was going to double-cross the doctor at some point. I enjoyed that it was a sort of small-scale double-cross in a sense. Basically, she just sort of tries to trick the doctor into killing Clara, as opposed to, ha-ha-ha, I took over the world. Well, you weren't looking, or ha ha, I created heaven while you were looking, or, you know, something like that. You know, that it was just this kind of, you know, rather small scale, very contemptuous of human life thing.
Yeah, there was a part of her performance there, too, where you could almost take it like she didn't honestly even believe it was going to work, but it was just too fun. It was almost like she couldn't resist doing it, because she still just has that, aw, rats kind of quality when it doesn't work.
But the one thing that I will say that I'm not 100% about is I think, if I'm reading this story correctly and I'm remembering all the details, this is the first time ever in Doctor Who that the Doctor just lets the Master escape without making any real attempt to stop her.
That is a little troubling. Yeah, at least John Pertwee would make an effort, like he'd even start to run in a direction, and, I got away.
Right. Right.
But yeah, like, he sort of trips over a chair or something. He got in the TARDIS.
He'll be back. We'll just follow the bodies. Why don't we move to round four, the big picture, and just talk about how the story as a whole worked for us. Now, it's a two-parter, so we've got the whole thing to talk about and criticize. So,
well, it ticked up in my estimation. It just considered individually, the second half was a lot more entertaining than the first one, which is a lot more just setting the scene. And here we had Michelle Gomez going bananas, and Clara in a Dalek, and lots of good scenes between the Doctor and Davros, and the only other chair on Skaro joke. Oh, I laughed. Yeah, I mean,
I did not see that coming. Yeah, it was great.
I'm sorry, I just want to really quick interject about the chair, because I think, we can be kind of harsh on Stephen Moffat, but I think it was beyond just a funny joke. It was a really bit of crafty writing, because I think Davros there making the chair joke and us laughing at it really sets up the later conversations with the Doctor, and you could believe that the Doctor and Davros would laugh. It's this little tiny joke that gets us in the same mindset of Davros in that moment, and the Davros hasn't made a lot of jokes in previous episodes.
I agree, and that's another reason why I think the scene of the Doctor stealing his chair was a later addition, because, I mean, once somebody has ripped you out of your chair and let you just kind of flop around on the floor, you think you could recover to the point where you could have that. You see where I'm going with this, you know? It seems totally incongruent with the rest of the episode. There were a lot of dumb things, lots of typical New Who kind of, regeneration energy. I guess we've seen that before, but it's not really any. I mean, it's a very Russell Davies kind of thing. And, you know, the Dalek sewers are a little bit too cursive fatal death for me. Too much
very
like
crazy.
The Master walking around in the sewers there, but and it's a totally wacko concept, but all right, I'm going with it. Sure.
Sounds yeah, I was slightly me. Startled to figure out that, you know, Daleks were basically immortal, barring a catastrophic injury. I was like, what? Well, it also might explain why there's first Doctor era Daleks around. There are actually that long lived, okay.
And to be fair, we've usually only ever seen them experience catastrophic injury. We're not watching the Dalek soap operas where they grow old, you know, the upstairs, downstairs.
The Dalek version of the last of the summer wine.
Yeah. Although that should be our next web series, you guys. We should.
Yeah. We wouldn't have to change the scripts. We just do the scripts in Daleks. So I agree with Pat. I found this one far more entertaining, and I liked this half of it better, which surprised me. Whether it belongs or not, the chair scene killed me. I actually really thought Moffat was clever in the way he presented the solution of saving Missy and Clara.
Yeah.
Because making it into this really fun backstory was A, fun to watch. B, he managed to get a lot of exposition out. He explained how Missy survived last season, last episode, and then also explained in that same story why the Doctor thinks he's going to die. You know, again, whether you buy it all, it is really well done. And you get to see Kara hanging upside down while Missy sharpens a stick, which was just a great tableau.
Yeah, all of that was terrific. And the little bits of, is it the first Doctor, is it the fourth Doctor, because you see the flashes of their costume in the old black and white footage.
Yeah, that was cool.
I mean, we also haven't talked at all about the whole translation bit with the Dalek, which was both hilarious and kind of scary in some ways, too. I thought that was really well done.
I thought it was terrific. It's kind of existentially disturbing in the sense that if we now understand that creatures trapped inside a Dalek shell can only communicate with a very limited vocabulary that doesn't necessarily mean what they intend it to mean, then what about all of these Daleks that have been killed over the years? What were the minds of the creatures that were inside them, right? Were they anything like Clara, or were they homicidal, horrifying maniacs like we usually understand the Daleks to be?
But that's a very good point. We don't know. The horror.
I know, Josh, if you were trapped in a Dalek shell, you wouldn't be able to do this podcast. It would only be like, murder, exterminate, destroy.
It turns the Daleks into, like, very tragic figures. They're basically forcibly mentally handicapped to be simply engines of war and nothing else. They cannot have any other identity.
You know, not to get too highfalutin about it, but this is very much a kind of 21st century view of this type of war psychology in a way that the original 1960s Daleks weren't, right? That was only years after the Second World War, and the Daleks were explicitly fascist. They were Nazis, you know, they were kind of cartoon people that existed in the same mental space that the English thought that the Nazis operated upon, and then they just kind of were like that for decades and decades, but now we're psychologizing these fascist warriors into a way that tries to make us more compassionate to them. You know, they're trapped in a shell that doesn't allow for their internal feelings to express in any kind of human way, but only in methods of violence.
And they have to scream exterminate to reload. Which
I'm not going with that retcon, but it was an entertaining master lie, we'll say. Yeah.
Fair enough. I have one question about the very end, and this is in the same vein as Pat's, maybe thinking about it way too hard. But when we got to the end, a question was, it really an act of mercy on the part of the Doctor when he's going back in time to perform an action that he knows is going to guarantee the outcome he wants, save a friend? Mercy, it seems to me, would be, you know, if Clara had been killed and he still goes back and shows mercy. Sometimes the problem with New Who is they want to open up some of these more complicated, intricate moral dilemmas and ethical questions, but then at the end they've still got to have a end and get to the next adventure. They can't keep going each episode and follow the consequences. It's not Breaking Bad, you know?
No.
But I don't know if any of that struck you at all.
Partly I was focused maybe on the narrative side of it, which was a little bit Bill and Ted, a little bit Curse of Fatal Death, right, where because of the consequence that you witness in your present day, you know that you must do something in the future that will allow the consequence to happen. And mm-hmm. So that seems to be what Capaldi was registering there. If anything, that kind of added sort of a sour note to my appreciation of this episode, because I had been pleasantly surprised that we weren't getting into timey-wimey stuff where he was going to have to go back and save Clara and the TARDIS and the Master from destruction by either killing or not killing the young Davros. It was all resolved in a present tense way. The Master and Clara had escaped and stuff like that, and so we kind of moved away from those impossible ethical dilemmas of time travel, but then we did kind of reintroduce it at the end. And so I don't know, Josh, I don't have any answer for that, because it's any sort of
an answer, Pat.
Calculus. Yeah. Ask Kierkegaard, I don't know, man.
All right, how about something easier? Let's give this a rating, shall we? And let's keep them as separate episodes. They have separate names. Or would you rather judge it as a whole?
Yeah, let's do separate.
I enjoyed this much more, so I'm going to give this 4 Davros tears. That's my rating. I thought I was totally engaged by it. Even things that, you know, I didn't like as much, or were little new series things that happened to get on my nerves, it was just so consistently engaging. I really liked it. Kelvin?
I really liked it, too. I'm going to give it 4 pairs of sunglasses. This is going to be a really strange comparison here, but in a very weird way, it's kind of like comparing Kill Bill Parts 1 and 2. The first Kill Bill is very crazy and over the top, and it mixes in a bunch of different styles and stuff. And the second one is slower, calmer, and more psychological, and more like just like a spaghetti western. Although that's not to say that The Witch's Familiar is a spaghetti western, but it's, you know, a more psychological kind of story. And my only hesitation is that it lacked a certain punch your fist in the air and go yeah quality, but I like the smaller, more intimate scale of it, so a 4.
I punched the air when he said the sewer is revolting. That was
pretty great, yeah. that just missed the, too bad Daleks can't do a rim shot, you know?
Oh, you don't want to see that.
No.
Kelvin stole my joke. I was going to say that I was going to give this episode 3.5 hoodies and a pair of Corey Hart sunglasses. But now that you've done the sunglasses thing, I'll do 3.5 hoodies and a copy of Immanuel Kant's Critique of Practical Reason.
All right, let's move to the fifth and final round, Wild Uninformed Speculation. So this definitely held nuggets of what the season arc is going to be, or certainly suggested it. I'm uneasy with the idea of retconning the reason the Doctor left Gallifrey. I guess it wouldn't be retconning. It would be adding something very concrete, which they've never been too specific about. But that makes me antsy and stuff talking about a prophecy and hybrids. I get all exiled out right there.
Ooh, I'm with you. Anything with a prophecy, I am not on board with.
I mean, in some literature, it's great, but I don't think it works very well in Doctor Who.
Yeah, it can stay in the Old Testament as far as I'm concerned. In no other literature has it ever been any good. Well, what did we get? We got Time Lord Dalek Hybrid coming down the pike somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an offhand reference to the Master's daughter. She mentioned that at some point.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Davros's line about, I wish that we had once been on the same side, might pop up again later in the season.
So here's my wild speculation now. Fear and speculation, because Buffett does like to troll fans, and last season there was a lot of criticism of Clara becoming the Doctor and being the protagonist, and we even had the glimpse of her face in the credits. She's in the Dalek when the Doctor is sending out his regeneration energy. We have the Master's comment about the, you know, the enemy inside a friend and vice versa. I'm just wondering if our goodbye to her is going to be like the rumored goodbye to Ace that was once planned, about her actually becoming a Time Lord and being left on Gallifrey or something along those lines. That's the whiff I picked up from it all.
Yeah, I saw parallels with Clara becoming a Dalek with Danny Pink becoming a Cyberman.
Oh.
You know, there's going to be a Dalek Time Lord hybrid thing, and it might get stopped by a human Dalek hybrid thing that is hopefully less dumb looking than what happened in Daleks in Manhattan. But I could see, some kind of like Clara sacrificing her humanity to Dalek dumb to stop something.
And so we still might get your marriage in heaven, you talked
There's
about.
There's going to be some scene of Clara and Danny in the afterlife, and it's going to be all glowy and angelic music everywhere, and I know it's going to happen. I hope it doesn't. I hope they do something less gross, but I think that's going to happen.
Well, guys, I feel a lot better because there's a lot of cynicism here. We were being way too positive. So.
Season finales are where New Who falls on its face. I wish season finales weren't a thing. I think it just boxes writers and producers and actors and directors into an unworkable corner.
You would prefer there to be a perpetual stream of Doctor Who without any sort of series finales or series openers?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, the need for season-long arcs in television is so universal now that and unquestioned and expected that I think it's kind of becoming more of a trap a lot of the time. And honestly, a pretty radical decision would be, oh my God, standalone episodes. What a crazy idea. I don't know.
You're a man out of time, Calvin.
Yeah, a little bit.
Never going to happen again.
I'm exaggerating for comic effect to some degree, but yeah.
It would be nice if they saved, like, the last episode to be more of a season epilogue or something. Didn't Joss Whedon do that in one season of show where the last episode was actually this very quiet, smaller?
Well, yeah, he likes to do that. He would finish up the big plot in the second to last one, and then there would be a little pendant or epilogue. There would usually be some sort of drama to it. Like, I think in season four, once they destroyed Adam, there was the Dream Slayer, the original Slayer that came back and gave them all sort of psychodramas that reflected on their characters in the seasons. I don't know why I'm talking about Buffy right now in a Doctor Who podcast.
I brought it up.
But,
done before.
My wife and I just watched the last episode of Justified last night, and that was kind of like that. The first half of the show was finishing up the plot, and then the second half was resolving everything that needed to be done emotionally and with the characters that you'd been living with for five seasons. And you can only get away with that if you care at all about the characters that you've been watching. But I think it's pretty effective. I mean, novels do it. That's why there's such a thing as a denouement, right?
Breaking Bad kind of did it. The very last episode was, well, we won't have Breaking Bad spoilers, I guess, on here. But yes, there is a way to do our television and not always end on the biggest, most climactic thing.
Well, they did that brilliantly, because they did the denouement kind of before the climax. Like, they suspended the climax, the very last few action beats, until everything else had been resolved. And then they did the last action stuff that you were expecting. And so they kind of did it probably better than any other show I can think of with in terms of how it resolved dramatically.
So Doctor Who should be more like Breaking Bad. Got it. Okay.
Absolutely. I think we're all agreeing on that.
Everything should be more like Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was spectacular. But, you know.
Well, on that note, that's our show. Join us next week when we talk about the next season of Breaking Bad. No, of Series 9, Episode 3, Under the Lake. Until then, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying,
get out of my world!
It's impossible to do that in unison without looking at each other.
Yeah, it can't be done.
Sorry, guys.
I just-